everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is the Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books they love, books and movies they love, and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this week this is episode 143. And we're going to talk about a book called Rumpole of the Bailey by John Mortimer. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
These are six short stories. And but they're kind of longish short stories, I guess.
Yeah, not terribly long. I mean, the book itself wasn't very long.
Yeah. And a lot of people may have heard of or seen Rumpole on PBS. It would have been in this country, but it was originally a BBC TV series that John Mortimer, who's the author of the book and was a lawyer and all this, wrote the screenplays for the show with his friend Leo McKern, who played Rumpole, in mind.
Hmm.
And so anybody who saw the show first, the show came first. And you would have had in mind, as I did, these iconic TV images as you're reading the book. Certainly I did.
Yeah. Yeah. And I had heard of Rumpole. I'm sure I had come across him on TV. It says his series were on like 1978 through 1992. But I don't recall ever watching a full episode or reading any stories.
Oh, okay.
But yet, when I look at Leo McKern, I know him. You know, it's like, ah, yes.
Right.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah,
so,
he's a familiar face.
Yeah. It looks like there's been 43 episodes.
Okay.
And, so it was interesting. You told me that was first. And so I was listening to this one. What's the guy's name? Patrick Tull is the narrator. And he was terrific. But then I watched a couple of episodes and loved it. I thought it was cool. I thought it was really good.
Did you happen to watch episodes that you had read the stories for?
Yeah.
Or were these different?
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I watched The Learned Friends.
Okay.
And The Heavy Brigade.
Oh, okay.
Brigade. Yeah, I have drunk almost no alcohol today so far.
Considering how early it is, I'm glad to hear that.
You bet.
Almost no alcohol. Except for that Bailey's in the coffee, right?
Exactly, exactly. Little pick me up in the morning.
Right.
Rumpole would approve.
Yes, we don't pull out the plonk from Pomeroy's until later in the day, the claret.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
Well, yeah, the thing that's kind of interesting is I remember after watching the show and finding that there were books, reading them, and my husband doesn't like much fiction, but he really loved these. And when I was rereading them recently, which is why I chose the book, I was surprised to see that these stories actually are so artfully written. It's not as if a lot of times, you come to the movie was first or something, and then you read the book and it's not very well filled in.
Yeah.
And I liked the way these were written with a lot of humor and intelligence as to, what someone's thinking or what the impressions were, or like he'll say, says, I had a sudden vision of my role in life from young Jim's point of view, and I gave him the voice of outrage, which I use frequently in court. I had a message of importance for Jim Timpson. And then he goes on into what would have been the piece of dialogue. But because of the way that's written, you see it flashing into his head. So you see, I guess, what John Mortimer had in mind when he wrote the script.
Yeah.
Leo McKern was able to convey.
Yeah, I agree. It was very well written. It was interesting to compare it to an episode.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the episodes, there is some inner dialogue.
Oh, is there?
Yeah, they show, not what you read, but sometimes he's thinking stuff and you can see him think, it's a voiceover. So he's sitting there like, for example, the one I remember is he's on a train. And he absolutely loves being on the train because he's away from the world.
Right.
And he's headed somewhere. And some of his inner thoughts are there. And then he wants, I think he wanted a claret, like you said.
Right.
And they didn't have it on the train.
Yeah.
And it was too early for gin or whatever else they had.
Well, yeah, and those kind of things also show that he is not one of these Sherlock Holmes type detectives. You know, he's a defense lawyer. He's a, oh gosh, I get the legal system mixed up. But there are barristers and there are other lawyers. And
yeah, like Queen's Counsel. It seems to be, yeah, and I don't fully understand it either, but it seems that Queen's Counsel would be a promotion.
Right.
They call it taking the silk, I think.
Yeah.
And
the barristers are led by the Queen's Counsel, which means the Queen's Counsel does most of the upfront questioning and everything, and the barrister's kind of like the assistant behind the scenes. And you can do trials without that two-person system, just the barrister, which is what Rumpole does, but it's usually for, as he calls, you know, the South City villains that he serves, like, you know, safecrackers, and it's not the high-level stuff that you get money for.
Right.
So he's a hardworking lawyer, and as we would say. And they also have another thing that we don't have, which is that if you know somebody's guilty, you can't try their case then, except for pleading guilty. You can't pretend that they're innocent if you know they're not.
Hmm.
And vice versa, yeah. which comes out in some of these stories.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. One in particular, I remember.
Right.
Yeah. And he does fancy himself a Holmes type of person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like how he views himself. He's going off the rails into things that the judges don't like and his fellow lawyers get nervous about. Where
right.
He's like, hey, I think I've figured out something. You know, look at the bloodstain pattern on this.
Yeah.
Which was great. I loved that part. I think it was the Heavy Brigade, the last one. You know, that's one of the episodes that I watched. And on YouTube... Okay. It was just somebody had put it up there, but they put it up there and there was an introduction by John Mortimer.
Oh.
And he was expressing pride that during the O.J. Simpson trial, they mentioned Rumpole and the bloodstains.
That's great.
It's all about the blood, as Rumpole says. You know, I guess one of the lawyers said that during the trial.
Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the things Hilda's bragging about at some point. Or I can't remember. Yeah. Is that the Heavy Brigade is the one with the dance at the end?
Yes, yes.
It's like, nobody knows bloodstains like Rumpole. That's why he won. And that's funny because he's got a very antagonistic view of his wife. They've been married so long. When he tells the story of how they got married, it sounds like he just accidentally fell into it.
Mm-hmm.
And
She asked him, yeah.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And her father was the head of the chambers, the law firm that he was in. And so he might reasonably expect that he would become eventually kind of inherit that role from him, which doesn't happen because he's kind of the working man lawyer. He doesn't worry about the fluff and kerfluffle of climbing the ladder. He's much more interested in trying his case and seeing if he can get his client off. And he actually kind of just wants to get his client off. If they did something, he doesn't care as long as they haven't told him. Because, like, I liked the one which was, I think it was one of the ones you watched, Rumpole and the Learned Friends. I think that's the one where he had the flu.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And he said he didn't have any real defense. So it says, lacking Harris or any other tangible defense, I had to fall back on the flu as ammunition for my learned leader, because he's being led by the head of chambers, who he views as a terrible lawyer because he's just always kissing up to the judge and worried about how he looks. And he says, accordingly, I brought to court a throat spray, a pile of clean handkerchiefs, and a packet of cough drops, which could be opened and noisily consumed during vital parts of the prosecution evidence. I ranged these weapons out in front of me on the first, remarkably uneventful day in court.
I love it. Yeah.
Yeah. So every so often he'll just, I better sneeze. I better, you know, distract everyone from what's been said.
Yeah. I think one of the things I loved about his character the most was this rejection of pomp and mm-hmm. you know, he, like you said, he just wanted to go try the case. There was one story in which the judge kept telling him, you know, that he was wearing his stuff wrong, didn't like his wig, somebody didn't like his hat. Right. And it bothered him that his hat wasn't liked, but he's like, why are they worried about my hat?
Yeah.
You know, I really love that about him.
Yeah.
And during the trial, you know, the judge is trying to tell him something about his tie or something. And he's like, why aren't you listening to what I'm saying? Right. You know, instead of worried about my tie.
Well, and he's so single-minded, and the reason he becomes a detective is, and it's not because he wants to be a detective, but he'll follow that thread of truth or something that looks as if he can use it as evidence until he finds out what's going on. And he really is doing it because that's how you defend your client. You know, he never stands around and says, I must do it in service of the truth. He will, though, take on things where he's been a lawyer so long, they'll go, well, I just got given a nice juicy rape case. And it's the person who's attacked or who's, they say, did the rape. And that's one where his son has brought his girlfriend, his serious girlfriend, to see his father work. And she's outraged because he's asking all these questions of the woman who says she's been raped. But they're perfectly reasonable questions to ask. But she just doesn't like even the idea of someone who's been through all that. And he goes, but has she? That's what we're trying to find out. Well, you know, I think the evidence speaks for itself. Ah, but that's for the jury to decide, not us. And so he's really a proponent of the system. But he wants to get it all out there and through every single story. Because I went on and kept listening to other Patrick Tull readings of different books. They're not all of them out there, but there are several more.
Oh, cool.
And in all the cases, in all the books, what comes out very clearly is I have to be allowed to present everything I possibly can in defense of this person. And so many people are making assumptions based on the kind of a case that it, oh, well, I just listened to one about blackmail. Well, you know, this gardener's accused of blackmail. You know, that's pretty awful. And he goes, but what if he didn't do it? Well, it's hardly likely this important person who's saying he was being blackmailed would lie. He's like, really? But this is the kind of thing that's going on all the time.
Yeah. And it's really an excellent thing for modern people to hear. You know, not yes. that these aren't modern. I mean, they stopped in 1992. But the episodes we're looking at were late 70s.
Right.
Or the stories that we read.
Right.
But these are very good points for us right now. You know, lots of assumptions being made.
Right. Digging to the bottom of the truth. Yeah,
and the truth? And the idea that we shouldn't ask the questions because it's too sensitive is something that needs to go too. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good. And he just has a really thick skin. Or maybe he's just so focused, because when he does realize that somebody, maybe like in one case, he gets hired because he's supposed to be a terrible lawyer. It's because of that hat, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, he'll never do.
Right.
And they hired him because they want to act like they're defending a person, but they really want that person to go to jail and take the blame for something. And he's just digging in. He doesn't get it until much later. Somebody tells him, and it really hurts his feelings. But then he shakes it off.
Yep.
And so I kind of love that going with it, because as you pointed out, they're the, you know, we can't not ask questions because, you know, you might hurt someone's feelings, but you also have to have kind of a thick skin yourself. Yeah, everybody's not going to love you. You might look funny to other people. And this is something I have a hard time with. I'm thin-skinned, and I'm continually going, if my feelings are hurt, it doesn't matter. You know, what do I need to adjust something that I'm, am I being a, you know, weirdo or whatever? Or, you know what, this is justified. I don't mind. I'll go on acting like this. This is fine. So I love that element of Rumpel that speaks to us, because the thing I really love about him is he really wants to know the truth, unless, of course, it's going to convict his client. Don't tell me if you did it. But,
right.
You know, he's like a bulldog.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, one of the things that came to mind while I was going through these stories is the death penalty.
Mm.
And the reason that it did is because of things that you mentioned, you know, people assuming and, you know, well, you know, I can look at that person and see that he's guilty. the problem is we make errors.
Yes.
And, you know, putting people to death because of an error is really unacceptable. And I think we need to err in the other side.
Right.
And it made me think of that. You know, it's just so obvious that, you know, these systems that we create are not perfect, and people aren't perfect, and we make mistakes. We make major errors based on assumptions.
Right. Well, yeah. And speaking of assumptions, I don't know if you've been on many called to many jury pools.
I actually have never sat on a jury. I've been called to jury duty a couple times, but I think that I made it to a courtroom one time, but wasn't selected.
Okay.
But I've never, so I've never sat in a trial.
Well, I've been on a few juries, but I've been called for a few more than that, jury pools. And if you do it enough, what you really get used to is walking into the room and you look at the people sitting there, and what the defense lawyer is always going to point out is, did you look at all of these people and say, I wonder who did it, or I wonder what they did? They're like, because that is something we don't know. We have to assume innocence. And what that does is remind us that we come in with assumptions. This person's on trial because they did something. No, they're accused of having done something. And I know I was on one maybe a month ago, and walked in and had that well in mind. And so the lawyer came at it a different way. And he just said, you know, how many of you, having heard all the questions that, you know, because they're doing the voir dire, which is when they bring up all this stuff going, would you have trouble with this? Would you have trouble with that? Say there wasn't video proof of this. Would that be still evidence from witnesses still be all right? And so I'm listening. And the defense lawyer says, so having heard all these questions about what ifs, how many of you, if the trial got stopped right now and you had to make your vote, would vote this person not guilty? And me and two other people raised our hands out of about 24 people. And mine was only because I had that in mind. I was like, because I'd been on enough of those. And he goes, I get it. I was a cop before I was a lawyer, but you have to come in. You should have all raised your hands. You have to assume innocence. And no one, you know, the way the judge system works in these books, the judge can just sit there and say the worst things in the world. Very prejudicial. Like, well, we all know this, Rumpole, you know.
Yeah,
and he's
yeah.
like, well, the judge was taking it to Rumpole again. You know, not in Rumpole's favor on this comment.
Right. There was one point in a story where he attacked the integrity of the police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an interesting one. And the judge was very annoyed by that. and his friends were too. Well, he said, you know, I think didn't the judge say, are you attacking the credibility of this witness? And Rumpole said, well, I'm not giving him a gold medal.
Right.
I think. Yeah.
Not giving him a pass, essentially. Yeah,
exactly. And I mean, there's one of those assumptions where this is the cop, you know, we need to not touch that.
Well, yeah. And so who are the people that we think are untouchable because of the position they hold? And then who are the people that we make assumptions about because we don't? Well, again, I guess it's social status or whatever, who we make judgments on. And some of them are things like, well, you don't think the same way I do politically, which we're seeing a lot of. People take it to a personal level. Or it can be as simple as, you know, the person you give a few bucks to.
Right.
Who's begging on the street corner.
Yeah.
You know, what assumptions are you making about them? Because I mean, and it can be something as simple as there was somebody who I gave a few bucks to last week and he, oh, thank you. And he points skyward and he says, oh, Lord, thank you. God is good. Thank you, ma'am. I'll pray for you. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, God bless you and all this stuff. And I'm thinking, now, do you mean that? Or are you doing that because it's your part of the exchange? You make me feel good. And it shows the other people and who are waiting in their cars that maybe, you know, you should be guilty. And so I'm like right there. I can't give them the benefit of a doubt for because it doesn't hurt me either way.
Yep. Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Rumpole would think about
it. We all have that. Yeah. Tough to fight sometimes.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. And Rumpole fights against that all the time. That's what's a very endearing part of his character.
And maybe it's because he's so constantly in contact with what would be called the lower elements of society. The Timpsons, which is his gang of local villains who they always come to Rumple when they're in trouble for theft or burglary.
Oh, man, there was a line in that one that made me laugh, too. Something about your family has provided employment for the legal system for years.
Yeah.
You know, he was thanking the
grandfather
the guy.
Will go, I remember when you were a young barrister and you defended me. Well, we're bringing young Jim to you. It's his first time in court.
Oh, it was good. It was good.
Yeah. So, well, and the other thing that I really like about these stories that also is what made the series so long lasting, it only ended, I may have mentioned this already, when Leo McKern died is when the TV series ended. Mm. And in fact, John Mortimer quit writing the stories for a while. He said, I wrote them for him. Mm. I can't do them any other way. And he did eventually pick up and write some more, which, you know, eventually you kind of get
to
the
point. So he has written some that were never filmed?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've read a bunch of them, and they're all good, you know. And eventually, right. though, you go, okay, I need a break from Rumple. But, but each story always has at least two storylines, sometimes three. There's always something with his wife, Hilda, or almost always. There's always something with what's going on in Chambers. That's the one that often gets dropped, I think. And, of course, there's the main case. And they all intertwine around one central idea somehow. And so what it makes possible is these stories have a level of depth. And maybe because they were written for TV in the first place, so you have to have more than just here's the straight trial. But that either reinforce or contrast with the main point. So, for instance, in one of my favorites where I was listening to it, and I went, oh, my gosh, because I'm a slow learner, and said, this is brilliant, which was Rumple and the Younger Generation.
Okay.
Oh, no, wait, I'm sorry. Rumple and the Alternative Society.
Okay.
And that's the one where he's on the train. He's gotten called to come out and to some seaside town, and he's especially delighted because his old buddies from the war – were in there.
Yeah.
The flyer and I can't remember what the woman did, but they're a married couple who he had jolly times with during World War II. And he gets there and what he finds is that there's a serious problem and the wife is trying to figure out, do I tell the husband what the doctor told me? You know, this way will lengthen his life. This way will, of course, if he keeps going the way he's going, it'll shorten his life, but he's got such a good quality of life this way. And on the other hand, the story you have, the main case he's there for is it's like this commune. And a beautiful girl who loves poetry, and Rumple loves poetry, he's always quoting Wordsworth, is accused of selling 20 pounds of pot to an undercover policeman. And so he's there to try to get her off. And in that story, there's a whole question of, when do you tell the truth and what for? And her boyfriend is determined that she be convicted so that she can tell the court this great truth that society has been ignoring.
Mm-hmm.
But at the cost of this girl's happiness, because the one thing she says is, I couldn't bear to be shut up. Well, if she is convicted, she will be. You can't get around a prison sentence for, you know, selling pot. And so it's, you're seeing these loved ones, do they really love you? Are they really thinking of your welfare? Or are they thinking of some grander, bigger question?
Hmm.
And those two things are, you know, and they don't exactly parallel, but that's.
No, it's neat how, you know, I'm thinking about how they're entwined. That's really interesting.
Yeah. They're played against each other that way. And Rumple and the Younger Generation is about, do you force people to follow tradition? And the funny thing is that this his band of villains, the Timpsons, are forcing their kid to take on their family feuds and their way of doing everything. And the big thing that he's hiding is he's going against family tradition and having a friendship with a family that they don't approve of.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas his son, Rumpel's son, is home, and he's trying to decide what he'll read in college, which is basically your major. And the wife keeps going, of course, it'll be the law. And he just assumed, of course, it'll be the law. And the kids keep reading books about sociology.
Right.
So there's that conflict.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I really haven't thought about those connections and the subplots. But yeah, you're right. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm. They're really, they're not always as, you know, in stark contrast as that, but there's always something there that is reinforcing or contrasting. And the decisions that Rumpel makes often are telling. Like at the, just spoiler, at the end of the younger generation, he realizes what's been going on. And he says, you read whatever you want. Don't, people following in their father's footsteps is a problem, you know?
Yeah. Right, which is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, fascinating. That's cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm thinking about the heavy brigade, where, mm-hmm. His wife wants so badly to go to the dance.
Yes.
You know, so, and that's like in the worlds, the three worlds you mentioned colliding all in one thing. You know, he's got the courtroom and the what did you call it? The chambers.
Right, the chambers. Right.
And he's got his boss or the QC who invited him to a dance. And he's like, are you sure? You want me to come?
Like legal ball kind of.
That was some funny stuff when he was, you know, saying, you know, with my wife, you know. With
she who must be obeyed.
Right, right.
Which is from H. Rider Haggard. Wasn't it called She?
Yeah, there's a book called She.
Yeah. And she is a beautiful, seductive person who's absolutely horrible. She's immortal.
Mm.
And she tortures everybody around her. And so that's, he just calls her She.
Yeah, that's something. Yeah. And he does keep putting in these literary references. So that's cool. And then Hilda's really desire to be part of society.
Yes.
Which Rumpel hasn't provided her, which has disappointed her so much. So all three of those things are happening in the heavy brigade all at the same time. And this scene, there's a scene where, you know, it's great on the TV show and in the story itself, where he is trying to replicate bloodstains by stabbing a sponge and noting the pattern of, you know, the water splatting everywhere. And she is talking to him about the dance at the same time. While he's doing that. And it's brilliant. It's so well written. It's just great. I loved it in both forms.
Yeah, because they're so often at odds. And he is so oblivious to what other people think, which is his very human side, because he's not perfect. And he's especially grievous in his neglect of Hilda, who, to be fair, is not a person that you feel sorry for usually. Yeah. Sometimes you might, but she's kind of like a battle axe. Not exactly, but close enough.
She definitely wants Rumpel to be something that he isn't.
Yeah.
And that's, it's like that, you know, however the marriage happened or whatever, that was what she expected. And she's very bitter because of it and always trying to push him, you know, are you going to get promoted? Are you going to do this? You know, there was one where he was sick. You know, she was like trying to get him to go into work anyway. And
you're home.
Yeah.
Daddy never stayed home, if that's the one.
Right. And I'm trying to remember who said, it was her. She was, this is a very human moment from her when, at the end of a story, he said, were you afraid? You know, because she was acting really relieved. And she said, yes, I was afraid that you would be home all the time.
Yeah.
That's what she was afraid of.
Yeah.
You know, because, they're talking. I think it's in The Learned Friends where he's sort of being shoved toward retirement by his colleagues. And he's, but he has no plans to retire.
No.
And then his success in that case made it so that he would not be retiring. So.
Well, and he's always kind of oblivious to stuff, but once he realizes things, then he'll just take very direct action. And I was thinking of the one, and also he really will defend people who there is no defense for, because what you see in contrast is how petty and small people can be. And this is shown in Chambers, like when, is it Alfred or Albert is the old Clark's name, the clerk who has in Rumpel and the Honorable Member, maybe, where they've marked bills in the petty cash because they think maybe Albert has been taking them for his own use. And so they want to get rid of him and just have a younger clerk. But that's the only way they can do it. Maybe they have tenure or something. I don't know. But and the way Rumpel reacts when he finds this out, he's like, but here are all the things he does that are valuable and all the things he does for us as a, you know, a group of people. But that doesn't matter because they want to get rid of him.
Right. You know, yeah.
He kind of shows the humanity of at least looking at both sides. Yes, maybe this person has done this thing wrong, but you always have to remember that one thing is not what defines a person.
Yeah. And I like that.
Yeah. It's, it makes me think, I can't remember. There was some football player who was accused of beating his wife or his girlfriend. And it looked like maybe the guy who dragged his wife around in an elevator and it was on camera. And they were talking some situation like this, because unfortunately this seems to come up, especially with younger football players, a lot. And he kind of went, okay, yes, and I'll do the counseling and I'll do these things. And so everybody's still castigating him. And they talked to some popular player who was a team member who said, this is a great guy. I love this guy. And they're like, what? And they said, I can't deny he did something awful. He says, but how many of us want to be judged continually on the worst 5 minutes of our lives? And I thought, oh, yeah, I've been pretty awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I may have a lot of good moments, but if all somebody sees is your worst moments and that's the only thing they'll ever give you a chance for, that's a cry for you need justice, but you need mercy. And Rumpel provides mercy in his way.
Oh, I love that thought. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah. And I've been unmerciful in both sides of that, right?
Oh, me too.
In judging someone and, shunning someone because of something that they've said, you know, whether publicly or personally or whatever. But then also on the side of being judged as well.
Yeah.
It's a tough it's definitely human nature, right?
Yeah,
and it is to be fought. Yeah.
Well, we're all sinners. We all have horrible moments when our sins bubble to the surface right in front of everybody. But and on the other hand, we can all be merciless in our judgment, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I liked what you said earlier about the groups, too. You know, we all seem to be splitting into tribes here. two major tribes, especially in the United States.
That's
been going on, yeah, especially lately, but it's been going on for years, and it just seems like to be this huge gulf. And then, you know, when something major happens, and then we recognize our commonalities, and, you know, I wish that that didn't have to happen for us to see that.
Yeah.
You know, start rowing. You know, there's a lot of things that we all care about that we could focus on.
Yeah.
You know, the rest, a lot of it is detail. I know some of it is fundamental philosophy, but it's difficult.
And I think, yeah, part of it is that what we forget is that our enemy, and I'll say enemy because when you're disagreeing with people that much, you know, you might not want to take a rock and hit them in the head, but they're enemies. And we forget that we all want essentially to achieve something good.
Yeah.
We have very different ideas about how to achieve that good. And that's where you have to remember there's a common humanity. So,
yeah. And Rumpel does help us do that. I mean, constantly, that is a huge value of these stories. They are more than just you know, I think we've portrayed that, but they're more than just a courtroom drama. They're deeper than that, like you said.
Yeah, at the same time as having touches of humor, because Rumpel is hilarious, some of the things he says or thinks.
Mm-hmm.
And they're richer stories than just like a Sherlock Holmes story, which I like Sherlock Holmes, don't get me wrong, but he's just, you know, about the mystery.
Right. It's a specific thing. Yeah. Have you watched Sherlock at all? I think we've been through that before, but
yeah, watched the first, well, I guess I've watched all the seasons. I did not like the last season because I don't know, I kept getting sidetracked from an actual mystery.
Yeah, the only reason I mention that is because I feel that that adaptation is a lot about the character.
Yes.
Yeah.
It definitely is.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
But the stories, you're right, it's all about the puzzle.
Yeah, and you have the friendship between Watson and Holmes, but that's the only real kind of human contrast that there is. You know, Watson is us and Holmes is the Superman.
Yeah.
And in this, everybody's very human. And in fact, it's really a relief when Phyllida Trant comes on the scene, because she comes in as a you know, like an intern type person, or just, you know, beginning lawyer. And he ruthlessly tricks her into doing everything that the judge they're going to appear in front of won't like, because they're going to be on opposite sides. But instead of castigating him, you know, she's not happy about it. But later she comes to him or acknowledges that, oh, that was very clever. You know, the way you did that, that was masterful. And she kind of sits at his feet. And I don't think it's in this book, but she goes on to become, she takes the silk. And much later on, she becomes a judge. And she always is the one sticking up for him. She always values him. And it's nice because nobody else seems to. They're either just climbing over him or, you know, not understanding at all his point of view. And of course, he's just as bad. He understands what's going on, but he just doesn't pay any attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot for it to come to the top level of what he's doing. He's busy. You know.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. So yeah, so I have Rumpel in my future. I'm just, you know, hearing you say that, it's like, you know, okay, so she's gonna move on to that. That's neat.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are other things, because as you know, like any series, that they're part of the fun is in seeing the development of some of the characters, what they go
into. And that's one of the things that makes for a good series, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Is that growth and change over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of series, especially from where this has come from, like the 70s and that, or, you know, every episode you're sort of ending where it started, so that the next episode, you know, they don't have to, there's no continuity over the whole thing, is what I'm trying to say. It's common now for that to happen, but it wasn't common in the 70s and 80s for a series to evolve like that. At least I think that was uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the series I think of were just self-contained stories, no real arc.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I mean, I know there are other series that do it, but you're right. That may be when that started, and between novels and the series of novels also and things like that.
Right.
I'd have to think back. And
well, I come from, you know, Star Trek mostly, right?
Oh.
The Star Trek novel. You'd have to end it where it started.
Sure.
Because, you know, the next novelist didn't want to have to deal with, you know, the death of Scotty or whoever.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and science fiction is different in some, I mean, it's real different than mystery. Mysteries really are, I mean, it's not that science fiction isn't about people, but like the kinds of settings you're talking about are different, whereas a series of mysteries, you know, you're dealing with usually the real world, essentially. Yeah. Even the Isaac Asimov stories about Elijah Bailey, and is it Elijah Bailey?
Yeah, it is.
And Daniel.
Yeah, Daniel Olivaugh. Yeah.
Yeah, Olivaugh. Those are sequential stories. You see how Bailey is changing. Mm-hmm. Elijah Bailey is changing as a person. Yeah. And that's kind of what you don't have to, as Sherlock Holmes shows us, but you can then use it for development. Well, the other thing I wanted to say is when he tells the truth, he also can look at the big picture that people don't want to think about. And that's, again, what we said about, you know, people just want to think about their own situation and how it affects them. And at the end of Rumpel and the Heavy Brigade, when he's saying, if you abolish crime, you abolish the basis of our existence. And they're like, oh, come now. And he says, abolish crime and we should all vanish. I felt a rush of words to the head. All the barristers and solicitors and dock officers and the dear old matron down the old Bailey who gives aspirins away with sentences of life imprisonment. There'd be no judges, no Lord Chancellor. The commissioner of the Metropolitan Police would have to go out selling encyclopedias. I leant back, grabbed the wine from the bucket and started to refill all our glasses. Why are we here? Why have we got prawn cocktail and duck a l'orange and selections from dear old Oklahoma? All because a few villains down the East End are kind enough to keep us in a regular supply of crime. And then somebody says, well, don't you help them? And he says, don't I what? And they said, help them doing all these crimes. After all, you get them off. And he's like, yes. He says, well, today I was no help at all. You know, because he stopped some villains from getting away with what they a frame job. But that's what people keep looking at him and saying, you're helping these people that we don't want to help. But that doesn't mean they're not worthy of being helped.
Okay, yeah. So I looked up the patron saint of lawyers, and I came up with two names, one of which we've spoken of before, St. Thomas More.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was neat. And we did a show on that movie, A Man for All Seasons.
Yes.
And I found this really neat prayer. It's called A Lawyer's Prayer to St. Thomas More, so I have no idea who wrote it. So it was interesting. Again, I don't know who wrote it, but it says, so it pray that for the glory of God and in the pursuit of his justice, I may be trustworthy with confidences, keen in study, accurate in analysis, correct in conclusion, able in argument, loyal to clients, honest with all, courteous to adversaries, ever attentive to conscience. Sit with me at my desk and listen with me to my clients' tales. Read with me in my library and stand always beside me so that today I shall not, to win a point, lose my soul.
I love that.
Yeah, and then the last paragraph is great too. Pray that my family may find in me what yours found in you, friendship and courage, cheerfulness and charity, diligence and duties, counsel in adversity, patience in pain, their good servant, and God's first. Amen.
That is great.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so St. Thomas More. And then the other person that came up is someone I'd know very little about, Genesius of Rome.
Yeah, he was an actor, and I read about him so long ago, but his story really struck me, and I haven't looked it up, so I could be off on some details, but it was so long ago that, like, I think you mentioned to me before we started about 300. But so he was an actor, and he mocked the Christians, and he was in a play that was mocking Christians, but he was playing a Christian. And in playing the Christian and putting himself into the part, he converted right then on the stage. It's like the Holy Spirit went, now you get it. And stood there. That's and awesome. Went, wait a minute, it's all correct, it's all right, this is the truth. And they were like, wait, what? All right, you come along here.
Oh, wow.
Took him off and martyred him, I believe.
Holy cow, that poor fella.
But I love that an actor is a patron saint of lawyers, because you do have to, well, Rumpel is showing, like, you know, with the flu stuff.
That's right.
He's acting.
That's
right. Also.
That's cool. So I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for Genesius of Rome, and at the end, it also says he is one of the patrons of the Catholic Magicians Guild.
That is great. But it never occurred to me to think about the lawyer as putting himself in place of you, which is what Genesius was doing. That's a really brilliant connection.
Yeah, it's fascinating that to think that an actor puts him or herself in the place of a person and represents that person to everybody is amazing. And, you know, that a lawyer does the same thing is also amazing.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that at all until you came up with that saint, or, you know, the church in her wisdom. Well, because until St. Thomas More, I guess that was the saint for lawyers.
Okay. Yeah, so Genesius, it says on this page, the patronage is actors, clowns, comedians, comics, converts, dancers, musicians, stenographers, printers, lawyers, epileptics, thieves, and torture victims. So I guess the torture that you said did happen.
I guess that's the martyrdom part.
Poor fella.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, but well, thank you for Rumpole.
Oh,
another one on the list. Yeah, I'm definitely going to, you know, at least watch them. But did love the print version as well. Like you said, there is a depth, and Mortimer is a fantastic author.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad you liked them.
All right. Well, sorry, we're having a lot of construction where I'm at. I'm recording from my office, so we're going to have to wrap this up quickly. unexpected sounds in the background.
Yes.
But thank you again for Rumpole.
I'm glad.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Another one on the list that I probably would not have encountered.
And Patrick, a lot of people have read these stories, but Patrick Tull is, to me, I love his narration anyway, but he's the one who sounds closest to Leo McKern to me also. Sorry, man.
Next up is The Witch.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're going to have a lot to talk about in The Witch.
Holy crap. Yeah.
But it's Halloween. It's October.
Oh, yeah. It's a horror
movie. We
need
to talk some horror. Yeah.
But it's not got a lot of gore and stuff. It's
no.
Yeah. More
it's psychological. Definitely. Yeah, definitely. So. But it's a movie that provokes thought and discussion. So.
Yes. And it's a listener request from my daughter, Rose.
Yeah. Fantastic. So there is the noise of which I speak.
Yes, so let's say goodbye.
So let's say goodbye. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. And sorry for the jackhammer.
Yeah, talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.